Well, tonight I want to take you halfway around the world into a way of thought which could not be more different than our own. And in order that this not be simply a, you know, list of quaint customs or practices, I'd like to try and deal with you as best I can with the presumptions of Buddhist thought, how it fits into its culture. And I'm going to need your thinking caps because, frankly, there are no familiar landmarks here. We're dealing with a mental set which is almost the reverse of our own. So suspend your critical faculties. Don't quarrel from the beginning with where the Buddhists begin. Their basic assumptions are as illogical or as logical as our own. One can't prove the basic assumptions we make about life and thought. Let's see what we can build up out of their practices. Now, to put everything into some kind of perspective, let's travel back to India, 2,000 years before the Common Era. There's some kind of native culture there. We don't know very much about it. We know that they build up a number of important city-states in the Indus River Valley, the most western of all the great river valleys of India. The river whose name gives its name to this civilization. The Bible calls India Hodo, Hodu after Indus. Hinduism comes from Hind, the Persian word for Indus, India. And around the year 1600, 1500 before the Common Era, this early urban civilization seems to have been generally animistic in its practice, that is, it saw powers, gods, and all the elements of nature, and to have had a religion, a way of thought, which was essentially geared to the agricultural needs of the community. There was a mother goddess, and there were annual fertility rites. This civilization was overwhelmed by a group of invaders from the north and the west, from the mountains north of Persia. We don't know quite where these Aryans, as they're called, came from. But about the same time that our ancestors were going with another group of mountain invaders down into Egypt, the Aryans came into India and built there amalgamated with the local community, subordinated the local community, which became the peasant class, and established that civilization which we call Hindu. Now, this Hindu civilization must be understood because it is the first time that the Indian culture surfaces in a way that we can comprehend it. And Buddhism, which will appear in the 6th century before the Common Era, 1,000 years later, is not an original thing. It is a revision. It is a reformulation of basic Indian ideas, basic Hindu ideas, but it uses the zeitgeist, the whole cultural baggage of the Hindu world. Now, according to the Hindu traditions, this world came into being by a primordial sacrifice. The original power, primal man, sacrificed himself. And at that very moment of sacrifice, the entire world as we know it came into being pretty much as we know it. The gods and men, animal, vegetable, mineral kingdoms, men came into being in the form into which we Indians knows them almost to this day, that is, according to their castes. From the very beginning, the world was as it is, and in Indian thought, the world will be almost as it is now. So from the very beginning, we have an assumption in Indian thought of the continuity of all things. We think of change. We worry about future shock. The Indians are not at all worried about the future, the classical Indian traditions, because the future will be as things are now. And according to this early Indian way of life, the most important act that men could perform religiously was to perform a sacrifice, which was a form of sympathetic magic, which was a duplicate of the original sacrifice which brought the world into being. This great fire sacrifice, which was performed by the priests, renewed creation, allowed creation to remain whole. It was man's act of cooperation with Brahma, with the supreme god, with the gods. And as in Jewish thought, and in Muslim thought, and in Christian thought, the time of sacrifice was a particularly dangerous time. You drew attention of the supreme powers to what you were doing. Otherwise, they were relatively indifferent to what an ordinary mortal was about. And so it was very important that the sacrifice be done in precisely the right manner, accompanied with precisely the right motions, the right melodies, the right movements. And this knowledge was controlled by the priests, by the Brahmins. This is an entirely oral civilization as yet. Writing as we know it, or even the cuneiform forms, the hieratic characters, had not yet been developed. And so there is a monopoly of knowledge necessary for the salvation of man, and therefore there is high privilege associated with this priest class. And this priest class of Brahmins was and remains down to modern times the high caste, the superior caste of all Indian civilizations. The survival of the community, the attention of the gods to the needs of the community required the sacrifices. The sacrifices required the Brahmins. The Brahmins obviously had privileges of power and wealth and freedom from taxation, from being brought into the courts, because they alone knew how properly to perform the sacrifices. So the castes exist in Indian thought from the beginning. The priest class is the highest class, and the sacrificial cult is basic to Hindu thought. Now, Buddhism will argue with the Brahmins' assumption of privilege. They'll argue with that the priests are the highest order of society. The Buddhists will argue with a whole sacrificial cult. There are more things important than these kinds of magical acts. The Hindus will argue for an openness of society that all may enter and perform and gain for themselves some form of redemption. Nevertheless, the Hindus will, the Buddhists will sustain the basic ways of thought in which Hindu theology and thought had been formulated. Now let me remind you of our own way of thinking about life. In the beginning, God created, Bereshit bara Elohim. And God created man and placed man in a paradise, and man was alone. And man was given a special mission to dominate, to subordinate all creatures to his will. And man was given certain missions as far as tending this world, and he was sent out to fill up the world, to be fruitful and to multiply. And some way along in this history, this hegira of ours, he was told there is a promised land, there is a messianic age, there is the possibility of building in paradise back into this earth. Life need not remain the brief, brutal, bruising, cruel thing that it seems to you now. There can come a time when every man will sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make him afraid. In our way of thought, life is an arrow. It points towards certain goals. These goals seem realizable. There can be a time when the world will be qualitatively as well as quantitatively different than it is now. Man begins few in number. Man multiplies in number. Man begins with crude forms to dominate the natural world. He increases his ability through science to dominate that world. We tend to think in terms of progress, in terms of development, in terms of hope. We are better than the caveman, both in our knowledge and our means of controlling our environment, and our means of providing a life which gives us a measure of decency, of leisure, and of security. But in the Indian thought, as I suggested to you, civilization begins complete, and it remains in pretty much its complete form right down through time. Now, there is a concept of eons, of a grand cycle of beginning and end. But these eons tend to be measured in hundreds of thousands of years. And as far as mortal man is concerned, life is conceived of as a great stream. Now, the stream remains constant in its thrust, it remains constant in its depth and its width, but there are waves and there are reflections given off by the ripples of the stream. There's a sense of change, there's a sense of surface, there's a sense of difference. But deep down, life remains constant, the same. Or to use the line from Ecclesiastes, which in this sense is very Indian in thought, that which has been is that which shall be done, that which has been done is that which shall be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Now to us, history is very important. I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. God defines himself by his intrusion into history, either for the Jews or by sending a savior to the Christian who brings into historical time a new dimension of salvation. There is no such intrusion in Indian thought. There is no such sense of history. They are indifferent to the progression of time, because the future will not be more blessed than the present, even as the present is no more blessed than the past. If there is any sense of time, it is the times are getting worse rather than they are getting better. Lacking this sense of an upward thrust, the Indian thought pattern tends to be concentrated not on deferred pleasures delayed to some future moment, but on the possibilities of understanding the moment as it is. None of the great Indian thought systems has what we call a social gospel. Go out, use your mind, use your skills, commit yourselves to the social, economic, and political reconstruction of the world. Because the world does not change. Men and society will remain pretty much as they have always been. There is no need to be greatly exercised about how we live, because whether we live in plenty or whether we live in poverty, whether we live in a machine age or whether we live in a primitive society, life remains brief, life remains brutal, life remains short. There is youth and there is age. There is love and there is loss. There is strength and there is illness. The inevitable measurements of life remain constant. The lack of pleasure, the lack of security, the lack of control remains part of what we must face. And lacking a social gospel, you don't find among Indian religious leaders men of the type of Savonarola or of the type of Calvin. Men who try by the force of their theology to create a Jerusalem here on earth, a totally religious community, which will be guided by God's law and governed by his way and religious to the core. Rather, the great ideal of religious leadership in India is the solitary, the monastic, the guru, the man who walks aside to cultivate his own soul, to find his own peace, to somehow escape from the trammels of the world, and whose usefulness to the world is an example of the way that others of equal strength and equal determination may want to follow. He may be a teacher. He may be one who is a good counselor. He may take another's soul and help that soul to develop new insight, new truth. But he rarely is a man of positive political concern. He rarely will try and transform his commitment to religious truth into some kind of political action or political ideology, because there's no point in political action. The only point that there is somehow to f- find peace for one's soul in this ever-moving stream, which is life, in this ever-recurring cycle, which is the world of which we are a part. Now, we tend to think of life as full of possibility. We encourage our children to develop egos. We encourage our children to experience as much as they can experience in the world, to fall in love, to commit themselves to other human beings, to be passionately concerned with some intellectual pursuit, some profession. We want them as much as we can be to be hooked up to the world, to be tied in to life. But in Indian thought, life in that sense is an illusion. And to love is to be is to lose, to be born is to die, to grow up is to grow old. This is, after all, a world which has always lived at the edge of poverty, knowing massive poverty, in which the lifespan was terribly short, in which most people not only didn't have enough, but didn't have at all, where most people, you know, managed to get some kind of minimal existence in very much the way animals do. So there was no thought in this world that life is full of possibility, that you grow up to go out, to conquer the world, to try yourself, to sow your oats, to enjoy what can be enjoyed. You'll never see an ad on Indian television which defines happiness as skiing down a great slope, or swimming in the ocean, or diving through the air. Happiness is withdrawal. Happiness is denial. Happiness is an unwillingness to tie oneself up into the wheel of life, to be bound to it. You've seen in the museums the Buddhist symbol of the great wheel. It's almost in stone, so it looks permanent. But the wheel is life, and it's in constant motion, and we are on the outer edge of that wheel, bound to it. And as the wheel moves, we are crushed by the wheel as it moves down. And what we must do is somehow find our way from the exterior of the wheel down the spokes to the axle, to the core, which is motionless, around which the rest of the wheel spins. Because as long as we're caught out there, where we are, every day, where we encourage our children to go by every act of which we are, in every relationship of which we're a part to them, we are consigning ourselves to misery. We are consigning ourselves to frustration. We are burdening our lives with emotional ties which can only cause us a terrible amount of pain. There is, in short, no hope in the Indian tradition of some kind of collective security, of national redemption, of a time when the world will settle down and there's going to be peace and plenty. All that there can be is somehow the individual jumping off the wheel, finding his way down to the center, to the point of motionlessness, finding himself at a position where he no longer cares about what we condition our children from the cradle to care everything about. He no longer loves another or cares in that sense for another. He or she no longer wants things, toys, experience, status, power, because to have any of these things is to lose these things and to be disappointed in them. If we want happiness, happiness is never what those little books that American Greeting Cards puts out, you know, which describes happiness as romping through the forest, or happiness as clutching a loved one's in your arms, or fondling a baby whose pants are dry, or something of this kind. Happiness is inaction, inertness, pulling away, dropping out, being indifferent to, in the sense that I can't be hurt by. And the Indian child, as the Indian adult, is conditioned, as is any Buddhist, to the possibility of a life without ties, to a possibility of a life without things, the possibility of a life of happiness which comes not through action, but through contemplation. Not by being aggressive, but by being passive and meditative. Now, lacking any sense of history or of progress, the Indian tends not to look upon life as we do in terms of linear cause and effect, in terms of progress, in terms of five-year plans, social planning of this kind. He tends to look upon life in terms of the possibilities of the moment, of finding the truth in the moment. We are investigative, and he is introspective. We want to know how something operates, and he wants to know what that something is in the first place, and how do we know what that something is, and what's the truth about it. We like to parse down, to scalpel out, to describe, and to define, and to lay bare. He's eager to see how all things relate to all other things. He's eager to find out how everything is part of this great stream which is called life, even though there seem to be individuals and chairs and beams and lights. He'd like to know how all things tie together. And the experience, the knowledge which he seeks, is not the knowledge that we have been taught to seek. We have been taught to ask, what's the use of? And he's been taught to ask, what's the truth of? And to find the truth, he doesn't tend to turn to the microscope or to the laboratory. He tends to turn and to question his own senses and to ask whether or not there aren't levels of experience where everything which we see as differentiated, as separate, is not in fact, you know, all bound together. So his mood is one which, his vision is one which we get when we press our hands to the eye. And we begin to see shadows and then shapes. And if we begin to think about what it means to be blind but enlightened, not to see what we normally see, but to see with the inner eye. If we begin to think what it means to think when we're in a state of meditation or exaltation or a psychedelic high, because drugs have been part of the Indian culture from the very beginning, associated with the oldest of Indian rites, the sacrifice was a drinking what's called haoma, which was a kind of liquid drug of some kind which moved people to an exalted state. When life begins to flow together, when shapes and colors and sounds tend all to blend together into one great phantasm or phantasmagoria, then we're beginning to truly see. That's the vision which he seeks. He seeks not what you say, but the vibrations that we give out. Not your individuality, because none of us have a self in the sense that we use it, but how we share, how we're all part of one ongoing continuum. Not the individuals who are in this room. What will we do? We'll count them. We'll name them. He'll ask, what brings them here? Each one is in search. In search of what? We're searching for truth. Are we searching for truth, or are we coming to, you know, for some objective thing, to be entertained, to be seen, to be numbered? How do we relate to what's happening here? Is it a lecture, or is it the possibility of truth suddenly blasting into our minds, not into the conscious critical level of the mind, but into the supra conscious, into those levels of the mind where the critical spirit falls away and we open ourselves up to a kind of range of possibility which we haven't asked about before. Meaning doesn't have so much of a message to the Indian traditionally as does mood, melody, possibility. You've heard that the nonsense symbols, the the mu, the nu, that are simply repeated over and over and over again. Why? Because they have a kind of hypnotic effect. They tend to be sound and to suggest thought, but not to be thought. And as we repeat some kind of simple motion or some kind of simple sound, and as we close our eyes and open up our other senses, we begin to sense in each moment all kinds of relationships and possibilities that we are not aware of before. But most importantly, according to the Indian, we begin to find in each moment the great undercurrent, which is the flux of all things. Because in the Indian, your name, your position, your biography, your height, your weight, the color of your eyes, all these are matters of supreme indifference. They are in constant change. Your body at this moment is changing into another body. More importantly, your soul at this moment is changing into another kind of soul by virtue of what's happening to you, or rather by virtue of what you allow to happen to you. So the question is not a name, was he there? A grade, did he get it? A lecture, did he copy it down? But how in this stream of life are you progressing in order to try and expose yourself to life, to understand life, to be part of the stream, to see the truth, which will allow you perhaps to escape from the stream and to find peace, because the stream goes on endlessly, and as long as you're part of it, you're burdened, you're weighted down, you're bruised. Life is samsara, which means life is a constant cycle of endless cycle of being. There is no differentiation as we know it between life and death. All is part of one great continuity. And just as much as you are not today the embryo that you were 30, 40, 50 years ago, but you are, so the corpse is not you, but it still is. And so everything that you are now will determine everything that you will be in this existence and in any other into which your energy transforms itself. To us, immortality, the possibility of living beyond these few brief years, seems to be a great blessing. Everybody wants to be immortal. Everybody wants to come back in heaven. We're all, in a sense, afraid to die. And we look upon the Buddhist idea, the Hindu idea, that there is a kind of transmigration of the soul, that we will be reborn in various fashions, as a great hopeful doctrine. And it was anything but that to the Indian. It was the thing he feared most, to be born again. The thing that he wanted most to escape. He didn't like life. There was no permanence to it. There was no security to it. There were only burdens to it and unfulfilled desires. He wanted to escape from life. He knew he was bound to this, to life, to this. He couldn't crawl out of the stream. He couldn't escape the wheel, except by not allowing the wheel to hold him down, to spin so fast he couldn't somehow get off, not allow the stream to go so fast that he couldn't withdraw himself from it. His definition of salvation is not the Christian definition of being reborn, or the Jewish definition of immortality of the soul, but it was to escape being reborn, to escape being immortal in that sense, and to find a kind of peacefulness, of quietude, which is inaction, inertness, the avoidance of all forms of rebirth. Nirvana comes from two Indian words, which means simply to blow out the candle. That's what he wants, to be snuffed out, not to appear again. He's aware that he will be part of this cycle, which is life, endlessly, unless he can somehow, by discipline, withdraw himself from life. And how do we withdraw from life? By not having too many appetites, not caring too much about worldly things, and most of all, by recognizing that there are states of emotional being where we feel that we transcend ourselves, where our consciousness has been expanded beyond the moment, where we no longer feel prisoner of this moment, these duties, this obligation, where meeting the family budget, going to work tomorrow, wiping the noses of our kids, giving them the medicine they need, these simply cease to have ultimate significance for us. And so in Indian thought, the religious disciplines, if I could use the word religion, are all the disciplines of withdrawal, of self-control, of introspection, of mystical experience. Yoga. Complete self-control. Passionlessness. The lack of movement. I sometimes talk about yoga to my confirmation class, and as I talk to them, I see them, you know, going like this, endless motion. That's our way of living. Can't be otherwise for our children, we train them for it. To the Indian, this endless motion is simply commotion. Pointless, even when we think it's directed for a goal. What he wants to do is to pull in on himself, to find that opportunity, that awareness, that truth about life, which will allow him not to care. Not to care about all those things you and I most care about. If any of us were to duplicate what the Buddha did, our wives would send the police after us for non-support, and no decent person would look us straight in the face. Because what did he do? He walked away from every single responsibility we hold to be sacred. Marriage, fatherhood, community, obligation to one's family, all of these things. He cared for something more. It's not that he cared less, but he cared for something more, and we can't think of anything more. There we have a kind of watershed or fundamental difference. Now, the disciplines of the Indian life are then not so much prayer, which says, give me something, because already to want something is a form of error, as they are meditation, dropping out. The congregation is really the monastery. The place where men go when they get to that point of maturity that they can walk away from their wives and their businesses and their governments and live a life of peace and meditation. Do you remember when U Thant was the head of the United Nations? There seemed to be no job which was more important in the world. And what did he do? The minute he could get out of it, he went back to Burma. And he found himself a monastery, and he put on the saffron robe, and he went, and he sat, and he forgot to the world. A world which we would have said he had a great deal of, you know, insight, administrative advice, and competent experience to give to the world. But that's not important, because the world is caught up in this wheel. It's spinning endlessly. Nothing he can do will change it. All he can hope to do is somehow to withdraw from it, to get out of it, not to be caught up by it. And in this world that spins on endlessly, all the kinds of nice logical divisions we make simply have no meaning. Man, God, good, evil, man, animal, birth, death, body, soul, this life, death, immortality. All these things are irrelevant. All that there is the stream of life, and what I am at the moment and am becoming. And my hope is somehow to live by a kind of discipline which will allow me to become someone who can escape from the stream, whose body will become so light that I no longer have to swim, who simply will no longer be carried along by the current. I'll float above it in a kind of perfect peace. And how do I find those disciplines? Find them by all kinds of denials. I deny my flesh. I deny my libido. I deny my status needs. I deny my love of luxurious things, my love of beauty, my love of love. I deny family and family ties, And finally, I must deny myself, because myself is at the root of all that I want. We try and tell our youngsters, know thyself. Find out who you are, what you are, and be yourself. To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. The Hindu, the Buddhist, the Indian would say, there is no self, in the sense of something constant, final, fixed, identifiable, unchanging. Our self is as much a product of becoming as our bodies. Our self is as much caught up in the eternal change of things as anything else in this world. We are at the moment what we are. What we are now, the thoughts we think now, will determine what we become. It's the law of karma. It determines how we will be reborn. But there's no such thing as self. I, different from all else. And to have this sense of I, which we do so much to cultivate, is ultimately to be unable to transcend self, to deny the world. The more I you have, the more you're caught up by the worldly, the more you'll be tripped up, the more suffering you will know. The hope is that you will somehow transcend the I and recognize there is no I. There is only life. There is only becoming. Is only part I'm only part of this great becoming. And my hope is to somehow get beyond it. Now, in this first millennium before the Common Era, the Hindus settled down, they began to create territorial states. People began to grow in sophistication, they began to grow in awareness, they developed mercantile classes. A noble classes who were willing to challenge the Brahmin power. And around the 6th and 5th centuries before the Common Era, there developed in India three great strands of religious reform, of philosophic reform, of which Buddhism was one, all of which use these ancient traditions and all of which seek to provide for men a way out. And I use the word men deliberately because it is a male-dominated kind of philosophy, whatever else it may be. The first is a reform of Hinduism itself, associated with the Upanishads. And in this reform, the great emphasis is on walking away, dropping out, leading the simple life, helping others to lead that life, and so mortifying the flesh, so denying one's appetites that one no longer has appetites. If I no longer want, the world can no longer hold me. I am beyond the worldly. And we can see this even in our own narrow way. Diet successfully for a few weeks, you simply don't need as much food. Diet to the point that the Indians did where the skin of your stomach touches your backbone and you will hardly need food at all. If you live simply, you have no need of clothing. If you're not worried about the elements, you have no need of shelter. If you have confidence, you can take the beggar's bowl and get a little bit of food to help survive day by day. And if you don't survive, so what? Life is a burden in any case. And by contemplation and by meditation in this state of denial, you reach, according to this Hindu version, a form of peace which transcends the stream of life and allows you to feel that you are now extricated from being. The second great reform movement was associated with the Jains, J-A-I-N-S. These men took self-mortification and self-denial, as did the Hindus to an extreme. The founder of the Jains wandered around absolutely naked to show he had no need of anything. He starved himself. He lived on a sesame seed, a kernel of rice a day. And he claimed and he taught people that there was life in everything, in this brick, in this paper, in you, in me, in animals, and that the great truth which one must know beyond the truth of self-denial is the truth which he called ahimsa, which means non-violence. The truth that you must, if you do no violence to any living thing, including the brick, including the light, including the window. If you live in such a way that your life in no way impinges on any other, then you are truly outside this eternal stream of birth and rebirth. And we've popularized this idea, you know, of the monk who won't swat a fly that's on his cheek, who won't take a bowl of simple water if there's a fly that is in it. But it goes beyond that. It's the idea that I must live in such a way that I have no claim on anyone and no one has any claim on me. No one, no thing. I am a completely independent being. I have cut myself completely away from life, just as I have cut myself away from my appetites. And the third great reform movement, which came at the same time, Buddha is supposed to have lived from about 1540-something down for the next 80 years, is associated with Gautama, the Buddha. The word Buddha means simply the enlightened one. His name seems to have been Siddhartha, which means the one who always achieves his end. He's also called Sakyamuni, which means he came from a tribe called the Sakyas, who are a tribe of noble people, princely people, but not of Brahmin birth. And his life is divided according to the tradition, like the tradition of Moses, the tradition of Jesus. We know very little at first hand. The stories about the Buddha were not written till 200, 300, 400 years after his life. But the story is that his life falls into three basic segments. Until he was 29, he was a worldling, a young prince, married, the father of a boy, a good hunter, a good charioteer, a king in training. And then for 6 years he went out and he practiced the Hindu forms of asceticism. He looked so to deny his appetites that the world could no longer have hold of him. And he found that he couldn't win through to complete peace of mind, complete truth. And then he had what's called the Great Enlightenment when he sat finally under the great Bo tree. He had a transforming experience, which lasted many weeks, and at that point he becomes the Buddha, the self-enlightened one, and he then becomes the leader of small and then larger groups of disciple monks who come around him. He attracts great support from some of the wealthy of northern India who give him open-air parks in which to teach, to build his monasteries. He establishes a monastic order which maintains itself for several hundred years in northern India, until his doctrines become popular with one of the great imperial princes of India, Asoka, in the 3rd century, who makes it a dominant cult in India. Now let's look at the Buddha, not in terms of a critical history, but in terms of the history as the Buddhists themselves tell us. And the first thing to remember is that the Buddha had lived many times before. He had to. He was part of the endless stream of life, which had been since the beginning. He had to have reached in his previous existences, by the kind of being which he had lived, that level of sensitivity, of awareness, of competence, which would allow him now to make the final step. And there are long sets of stories, they're called the Jataka, in the Buddhist tradition, which tell of the previous existences of the Buddha. Many of these stories are very much like those of Aesop's fable, the tales of animals and life and so on. He's born near Nepal in northern India. He's born of a princely family. At his birth, the soothsayers predict that he will become either the imperial master of all of India or the great enlightened one. There are all kinds of signs and omens and portents about his greatness. His father worries about his being a Buddha. No one likes to see their child go into a monastery, even in an Indian civilization. And so he tries to provide him with a life experience which is very much like that of Shaker Heights or Pepper Pike in the 1960s. God forbid my child should see any misery, illness, want, deprivation, and so on. He lives in a pleasure park. He's married early, a very beautiful girl. They have a lovely child. He's taught all the sports and all. He's given all kinds of companions with strict orders that he should see no unpleasant things. But something moves in the Buddha's soul, and One day when he and his charioteer are out in the little town in Nepal, which is a lovely part of India, they see a sick man. And they have a conversation about this man, and the Buddha recognizes that all health leads only to sickness. The next time they wander out into the village, they see an elderly man, an aged man, an infirm man. And he recognizes in the conversation that all youth gives way to age and all too quickly. And one time after that, they wander out into the village, and now they see a corpse lying on the street. And he recognizes that life disappears quickly. To be born is to die. And he begins to think about these things, and his mind is of a high degree of sensitivity. And he becomes aware of the basic impermanence of all that is, and that's the basic Indian insight. Nothing that we value really has value. And when he wanders out a fourth time into the town, they come across one of the monks with his beggar's bowl, lean, emaciated, but he seems at peace with the world. He's satisfied to depend on whatever decent people will give him day to day to live by. And they talk about the monk, and the Buddha recognizes that this monk, who has nothing, in fact has everything, and that is, he has what we might call peace of mind. He determines to go out and to live the monk's life. And that night, while he's at home, he gets up in the middle of the night, and he looks down at his beautiful wife, and he walks away from her. He looks down at his lovely little boy. The boy's name, interesting, is the Indian word for bond, Razul, the ultimate bond that might hold a man to his family, to the material world as we know it. But he looks down at the boy, and even the boy can't hold him to the world. And he and the charioteer leave the castle, and they go to the forest, and there he cuts off his hair, and he begins a six-year novitiate in being an old-fashioned Hindu monk, denial, self-mortification, flagellation. He learns to control his appetites. He learns to defeat Mara, the deceiver, the temptress in Indian mythology. He learns to deny the flesh, to live a very puritanical life. But he cannot completely come to peace. His appetites are no longer, but his mind is still somewhat confused. It hasn't come to that great moment of enlightenment. And he recognizes that he will never find it simply through the path of denial. So he returns to the edge of the forest, and his disciples who have followed him give up on him because they recognize that he has lost this test. But now he sits under the great bow tree and in the lotus position, the quiet position, and after weeks of contemplation, he suddenly has the long trance, the meditation, which gives him insight. And this insight is interpreted in specific ways in the Indian tradition. What does he learn? He learns in the first place that all existence is suffering, all that I've tried to say to you so far. There is no permanence to it. Even the things that give us greatest pleasure give it to us only for a very short period of time, and we have more aggravation and more frustration and more grief from the desperate loves that we have than we have pleasure. If all existence is suffering, whence comes suffering? And the answer is that suffering comes from craving, from wanting, from desire. If I don't want, I don't suffer. I'm at peace inside. I'm the same within as without. So the craving, wanting, desire is the cause of suffering. Now what do I do to avoid suffering? I obviously eliminate all my cravings. I avoid all the things, I learn to avoid, not to want, all the things that Western society tells me I need. How do I go about this? I go about this by denial. I go about this by all the traditional ways which India has known, but I do so in a more, what's called the Eightfold Path, by a discipline which has many levels to it, a discipline which trains the mind even as it seeks to train the body. For to the Buddha, the great life energy is mind. And it's the mind which controls what I do. If I can control my mind and not want in my mind, be clear in my mind, clarity will give me security and will give me peace. What is this Eightfold Way? first is called right views. Views about appearance and reality. What is true and what is false. What is necessary and what is deceiving. And most of all, views about myself. I must learn to see myself not as a self, but as part of life, part of all that is, part of the great unity which is nature, whose needs can never be separated out from the totality. I must learn to have right motives. I must learn to do what must be done because I consciously will to do it, not because I am moved by instinct or moved by passion or moved by appetite to do it. I must learn to renounce all the so-called pleasures of life, food, power, love, sport, all the needs of the body, all the needs of our ego. All these I must renounce. I must learn to cultivate right speech, to avoid angering others, gossiping about others, maligning others, being brutal to others. All these I do because of ego needs. Most of our speech, when we respond, is in order to establish our dominance of another, to get back at another, to gratify another, to stroke another. There's very little communication which is open and free and easy. And I must learn to speak with others when I speak with them, and I should speak rarely, only to speak the truth. And if the truth hurts, I speak it not because it hurts, but because it is a truth that must be spoken. And if I speak of consolation and comfort to another, I speak it not because I am gratified to be able to give charity, but because that word of comfort ought to be spoken to the other. The ought becomes important. I must learn right conduct. And by this I mean not going out and fighting the good fight, but not killing, not stealing, not lying, avoiding all sensuality, avoiding liquor, and all of the appetites. I must learn something about livelihood, because there are many ways in which I can be a Buddha, an enlightened one, and sometimes the Buddha must be a teacher, sometimes he is a solitary. Sometimes he's dealing with people of power, sometimes he's alone with his thoughts in the forest. I must learn there are certain things I cannot do. I cannot be caught up in anything which requires that I take life. As a soldier, as a butcher, as a politician, I must learn that I cannot do anything in which I am manipulative of another human being. I cannot force others to do my will, either to force them into slavery or into prostitution or anything of this kind. And finally, there are then disciplines of the mind which I must learn to control. They're called right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. They involve yoga, deep breathing, disciplining oneself so you do not allow certain kinds of thoughts to surface, and if they surface, you quickly control them. Keeping yourself from fancy, building castles in Spain, from idle thought. Earnestness, much prized Buddhist virtue. All of these I must somehow control. Now, there's not a great deal of lightness in all of this. It requires a great deal of effort and of concentration, but there it is. It's nonviolent, it's cutting oneself away, it's not intruding on others' lives, it's not manipulating another's human being, it's learning to repress one's natural ebullience, one's natural desire to touch, to relate, to feel, to care. It's learning to find a kind of peace above, despite, beyond the confusion and the roiling of the world. It's not very much of a religion, except in the sense that it provides a way to a kind of personal salvation. For the many, there is only the hope that they can, by being close to the Sangha, the community of the monks, that they will somehow, by serving them and by doing what they can of the Eightfold Path, that they will somehow improve what is within them to the point that in the inevitable cycle of birth and rebirth, they will be reborn in such a way that in some future existence, the hard, difficult way of the individual because a path of individual deliverance will be possible to them. Now, in the Buddhist faith broke up in a Buddhist way very quickly after the Buddha's death. For the many, it was too difficult, too narrow a way. There remained those who were called the Theravada Buddhists, that is, the Buddhists of the, who were called the followers of the elder teaching. These are essentially the Buddhists of Ceylon, of Burma, of Thailand, of Southeast Asia, not the Buddhists, by the way, of Laos or Vietnam, but for the rest of Southeast Asia. They feature the life of the monk, the saffron robe, his begging bowl. The emphasis is on the individual, and there is no promise that the individual can perform magical or mystical rites which will benefit the group as a whole. There's very little ceremony. There is no prayer as such. There is the open monastery and the open way through the monastery. Most of the northern Buddhists, the Buddhists of Tibet, the Buddhists of China, the Buddhists of Japan, are called Mahayana Buddhists. Mahayana means the greater vehicle. And it's by and large a blending of older religious elements and this kind of consciousness expanding form of Buddhist withdrawal. There are in the Mahayana systems prayers which can be offered. There are icons that can be prayed to. And there's a new kind of being. The being is called a bodhisattva. This is a man who has attained the possibility of Buddhahood, of complete self-extermination, but who stops short because he is concerned with your well-being and with mine. If you pray to through these bodhisattvas, and most of these bodhisattvas are simply the old gods of Tibet and China and Japan thrown into Buddhist biography, they will somehow intercede for you, help you along the long and difficult way that you must go. They are the angelic helpers. They are the intermediaries. They are male and female bodhisattvas now, as the male and female gods of the early cultures are absorbed into Buddhism. But the basic emphasis on meditation, on withdrawal, on rising above the stress, the press, the ties of life, these remain in all forms of Buddhism, and they remain, I suspect, part of what makes Buddhism attractive to those who want to drop out from our society. Because here you have a complete self-enclosed rationale for dropping out. I can't do anything anyway. All I can do is to save myself. It's no easy task to save oneself in this world. Let me be. I'm harming no one. The world can't be changed in any real way anyway by anything that I may do. And the only answer to that, if answer there be, is by God, we better give it a chance. And now it's your chance to throw questions at me. The question is, I haven't distinguished between the Hindu and the Buddhist faiths in India today. I try to describe Buddhism essentially as a reformulation, a reform of Hinduism. By about the 6th century AD, the Brahmins had absorbed enough of Buddhist ideology to be able to make the same kinds of appeals to the mass population at the same time that they provided them the gods to whom they could pray for other kinds of things. And Buddhism, for all intents and purposes, disappears from India. And you don't find it very much in India today. You find it in Ceylon, you find it in Bangladesh, and then further to the east. But India has to, in a sense, be re-imported. I mean, Buddhism has to be re-imported into India for it to be a major faith there. What does the word Zen mean and how do we associate that with Buddhism? Zen comes from a Chinese word called Cha'an. And Cha'an comes from an Indian word, which I don't remember, which means meditation. Zen Buddhism is a Buddhism which was imported into China around the 6th century, imported into Japan around the 10th century, which says essentially, it's all very interesting about the Buddha. It's all very interesting about it, the various scriptures of Buddhism and its teachings. But the only thing that's really important is immediate intuition, immediate awareness of that which is. If I can get further by throwing the Pali scriptures, the Tripitaka or something into the fire, I'll throw it into the fire. I have to shock you into an instant awareness of truth. There's no other way. You've got to do it yourself. Words can't do it. Teachings can't do it. Language can't do it. Only a kind of simulated experience or real experience can do it. They have monasteries. They tend to be rather sparse. Their goal is what's called Satori, which is a kind of nirvana, a blowing out. You blow out the mind. You blow the mind, to use the way the kids say it, and you learn very quickly that all is insubstantial, all is ephemeral, all is unreal. The only reality is the mind, and the only reality is the need to find peace. And the way that they go about Zen is to have a kind of vigorous monasticism, which combines labor and early hours and a great deal of mind-boggling kinds of quick give and take. Forces you to think about things as they are. As an example, the teacher will ask, if you have a bottle and there's a live goose in the bottle, how will you get the goose out of the bottle without breaking the bottle or harming the goose?
That's not... the same way you got it.
Now, you're all Americans, you all assume there's an answer. There's no answer. The answer, it's out of the bottle. It's out. What makes you think, you know, it's in. On one level of reality may be in, another level of reality, it's out. Or, that's the sound of hands clapping. What sound does one hand make? Ask me a question, I'll give you a Zen answer.
In this concept of ending life and going into another life, what's this other life? What's the continuum?
Life. What is this? What is it? It's anything and nothing. Anything we want it to be and nothing. You're asking a question. Your question is based, Lou, on logic. Therefore, it's wrong. It assumes that there's a kind of linear progression, cause and effect kind of relationship between things, which ought to make all things logically ascertainable. But they're not. None of the ultimate things are logically ascertainable. All we can do is to say, it goes on. It is. It's part of being. I can't tell you what life. First of all, I don't believe this whole business, you know. So I can't argue logically with you, or give you a good logical answer. But the point is that there is no logic to the answer. Karma is simply this statement. We are part of a process. The only thing that is really is the moment in this process. The soul is as much a composite of things as the body.
If you scalpel them all down, there's nothing but emptiness there. There's no ultimate essence called soul. What informs the soul is something which we call personality or thought. The Indians would call thought. This thought is constantly changing. And yet this thought makes what tomorrow will be for us. We are, in a sense, what we think or what we can. That's, in a sense, the karma. It will determine what we become as these various parts move on and become other things. And what they will become, I don't know. The Indians certainly, the most thoughtful of them certainly didn't have that very crude concept, you know, that you're going to be reborn a beaver or a badger or a white elephant, depending upon what you are. You're going to be reborn as, you're never dead. The whole thing is simply this constant state of becoming.